From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the August edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month we go back to wartime Bletchley, when Winston Churchill visited the Codebreakers. Sir Arthur Bonsall gives us a glimpse of what it was like. We'll hear from Bletchley Park podcast roving reporter Kerry Howard and science and technology presenter Maggie Philbin, chatting during a visit to Bletchley. Maggie told me about what her mother did during the war. That makes fascinating listening. But first, what are those dreaded words you hear so often at this time of year?
Mindfuls!
Well, not for much longer. All you have to do is bring your children along to a family fun Wednesday at Bletchley Park. Every Wednesday throughout the summer holidays, we lay on workshops about spies and codebreaking, special trails and tours for children aged from 5 upwards. This year we bring you two new workshops, 006.5 for under 7s and Ultra, where 11 to 14 year olds can learn about the work of the Government Code and Cipher School during World War II.
We are going to think today about some of the skills that we might need to be a really good spy. So what kind of things do you think you might need to be good at if you're going to be a really good spy? Yes?
Be good at hiding secrets.
Good at hiding? I like that one.
You need to be really quiet. Keep secrets.
Good at keeping secrets. Excellent.
Good at telling lies.
Good at telling lies.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
What else?
Good at disguises.
Well, we're going to practice our disguises a little bit later. But there's one that nobody really said. We had to keep secrets, but nobody told me how you were going to find things out. So my first challenge for you is going to be finding out the information. Up here is going to be a looking challenge. Now, grown-ups, no cheating. Kids don't cheat at this one, it's the grown-ups that cheat at this one. So I'm going to ask the grown-ups to make sure they've put all their pens and pencils down, all their crayons down. I am going to show you 20 pictures. And I'm going to put it up for a whole minute. When it goes away again, you're going to need to tell your grown-up all the things they need to write down to get as many as you can. Are you ready? Your minute starts now. So we've got the rainbow and the dog. You've all had to go at reading some secret messages, and some of you have written messages back to me, which is fantastic. The third thing is blending in. Well, at the moment, you all look quite ordinary, but unfortunately, I'm going to send you on your first mission later on, and that is going to be that you've been invited to a masked ball. So you need to have a mask that is colourful and beautiful, and that will help you fit in at this ball. We have got some elastic for you to attach them around your head. So if you want to finish colouring in your mask, you can. You've done really, really well. Your blending in skills, you look perfectly normal right now. Hopefully you'll fit in at the mask ball as well. So I've got your spies in training badges, because of course your training hasn't finished. So thank you very much for joining us. If you have any feedback, we're always happy.
My name's Lindsay Newman and I am one of the education volunteers here at Bletchley Park. I run the Agent 006.5 workshop, which is for under sevens, and it's our new workshop for this summer aimed at the younger students and the younger kids that come to the park. So we do some really simple code breaking. They write messages to each other as well, and they also do kind of colouring and disguises for themselves for their first mission that we send them on at the end of the session. So it's a short session to get them into code breaking, to introduce them to a little bit about what Bletchley Park is all about, without being quite as taxing as our spy workshop, which is for kind of 7 to 11 year olds. For those that are slightly older and have done our spy workshop, we also then go on to do an ultra workshop, which is for our over 11s and has even more challenging codes to break, and they get introduced to the Enigma codes and do some work on breaking Caesar codes and Enigma codes without any help at all.
So you've just finished your first day of workshops of Agent 006 and a half. How did today go?
I actually really enjoyed today. It's good fun working with the much younger ones. They seem to really enjoyed it. Been really great to see some 4, 5, 6-year-olds getting into code breaking, telling their parents what to be doing and what letters to write down. So I think they've really enjoyed it and I've had a really lovely day.
And I'm guessing from the date and knowing that you are a teacher, this must be your first week on holiday. So what are you doing at Bletchley Park with another bunch of kids?
Yeah, good question. It's one of our local big attractions and it's such an important part of the heritage of Milton Keynes and Bletchley to be here in Bletchley Park. And I started volunteering here about 4 years ago. I've always worked on holidays because I've always been in school during term time and I kind of love doing something completely different. I teach older kids, so I get to come and work with completely different age of children doing completely different topics. I don't have to worry about them being quiet and learning something particular. It's just coming in and having fun and getting to share some of our local history with a generation that don't really know a lot about it. And also I learn something more about Bletchley Park every time I come here, every time I go on someone else's tour, every time I go to a volunteers meeting. I just find out more. And I personally just find it fascinating. So I love coming and just finding out a little bit more and then getting to share that with kids.
Thank you.
Coming up at the end of August is a new event connecting the past to the future. Find out what it takes to be a codebreaker, from the geniuses recruited to GCNCS in World War II, right up to today's digital age and the work of GCHQ. You can try your hand at workshops and find out if you're made of the right stuff. That's New Enigma on Saturday the 31st of August and Sunday the 1st of September. If I say Maggie Philbin, you'd be forgiven for thinking first of the iconic science show Tomorrow's World, but she's actually been presenting and reporting on science, medical and technology programmes for more than 30 years. Maggie also happens to be a great supporter of Bletchley Park and was here recently to record a programme for BBC Radio 4 Extra. We'll be able to tell you more about that later in the year, but while Maggie was here, we chatted about signals intelligence, her mother's vital war job, and how war is often the driving force behind the development of new technology.
So this is by far not your first visit, is it?
No, I've come here a couple of times, and it's such a remarkable place. And every visit you see something else, something you didn't notice before, or there's more to explore. I think, obviously, the historical significance of the site is so great. But what's really valuable is that the way that Bletchley seems to have evolved. So many of the tour guides here, for instance, were people who have got a connection to the place. And I feel I've had that privilege in the past of having someone explain the bomb who actually worked on it. I have to confess that I had to ask her to explain it to me 3 times before I began to really sort out in my head what was going on with it. But it's obviously a very important place to come when you're talking about the history of IT and the significance of what happened here. And also a few of the what-ifs. What if the general knowledge that had been gathered through the war years hadn't been subject to secrecy? And perhaps this collection of people had been allowed to work on. Would this be Europe's Silicon Valley? There are a number of sort of interesting questions. But for me as well, I think the thing about Bletchley is it's always human need that drives technology. And computing took such a massive leap forward, in many ways very sadly, because of the war, because of the need to protect and save lives and to make, you know, whether it was warships less vulnerable, just being able to give them information about the Germans. But it did move technology forward. And in a very odd way, we're all benefiting from that.
Of course, it's the oldest saying in the book, isn't it? Necessity is the mother of invention. But really, it throws so much resource at things, doesn't it? But then the irony of it is they couldn't then capitalise on their achievements. What must that have been like?
I know, it must have been extraordinary. And I think, as well, it must almost have been a habit that was born here because, you know, you learn about how if you worked in Hut 6, you wouldn't know what people in Hut 5 were doing. And so there was a real level of not telling anyone. And you can imagine that if you were here for, say, 3 or 4 years, that becomes a real habit. You get into this habit of not telling people what you're doing. And I think one of the really sad things was that even when people were allowed to talk about what they'd been doing, some of them didn't find out that they could, and others found it too difficult because somehow it still felt wrong to talk about their work.
I met a lady yesterday who came to visit, and she talked about that. She said when it first started to come out, she was horrified to her very core and couldn't cope with the idea at all that you would talk about it, because it's so ingrained. And I think what we forget now very easily is that all-consuming culture of the war. Everybody had a part to play and everybody had a responsibility.
Yeah, and they took it really seriously. And also the degree of pride that they took in the work that they were doing. So I'm sure initially when you first came to Bletchley, I'm sure there were quite a few people who felt quite rebellious about not knowing what really was going on here, because very few people knew the whole story. Most people just knew a little corner of it. But I think, as I say, you know, after a while it becomes a habit and it becomes a way of thinking and it becomes almost a philosophy, really.
And it's completely ingrained.
Yeah, absolutely ingrained. And then it's very hard to feel comfortable if you are talking about it.
We still get veterans now who sort of say, am I allowed to tell you about that? And you say, yes, and you have to winkle it out. It's quite difficult. Some are taking secrets to their graves. It's just an inevitable result of this. On a slightly different subject, you've obviously been looking at and finding out about and learning about and telling people about technology for a large chunk of your career, at least. Can you remember the first time you heard about Bletchley and what happened here and the importance of it?
Well, I think I'd heard my mum talk about Bletchley because she worked in signals during the war. She worked out at Waddington, and then immediately after the war she went out to Egypt. And one of her cousins worked at Bletchley. But I didn't have the faintest idea what Bletchley Park was at all. I mean, she didn't say very much about that. When she talked about her work, it was very much in, you know, certain little vignettes around the edge. And I'm sure that that, for Mum, was the same kind of thinking, is that a lot of the stuff that she did and her role in signals was that she had to bring stricken aircraft back to the nearest airfield. So for someone who was 18 or 19, as she was, this was an extraordinarily responsible job. But, you know, when you talk to Mum, she doesn't talk about that. You know, she talks about other things. And the war was clearly incredibly important to her. And she died about 3 years ago now. And she made sure that in her wardrobe, she had brought together all of, like, her letters from the war, but also all of the code books, all of the Morse code books, while she'd been learning how to send Morse code out to the various aircraft. And it was just obvious that, you know, that that was still her identity. She might have been 89 years old, but those years, those 4 or 5 years when she was in the forces were her identity. That was who she thought she was.
Wow. It was defining, wasn't it, for the rest of a busy life?
Absolutely, you know. And also we discovered that Mum, again, this was after her death, that she had 3 medals. She'd never bothered collecting them, and one of which is quite rare. That's typical. And it's a totally different attitude. If I'd been Mum, I'd been wearing those medals, you know, all of my life, but that wasn't her way. So it was incredibly important to her. Like all these women who worked at Bletchley, all of the bright young men who came from, you know, universities and were recruited because they were great at crossword puzzles, they saw themselves as part of a massive effort. And they took their jobs and their role incredibly seriously, but they were part of a very massive picture.
It must make you think of her coming here then.
Yes, it does, yeah. When you look at lots of the pictures around this place, I mean, this is also something that's just fantastic about Bletchley, is that the ephemera, it's everywhere. It's in the buildings, it's in the pictures all over the walls, it's in all of the pieces of equipment, it's in the smell of the place. And, yeah, it takes me back to a time, and it actually helps me perhaps understand a little bit more about what Mum did and what lots of other people like her did.
And why she played it down the way she did.
And why she played
it
down.
Didn't claim her medals, didn't make a fuss.
Yeah, didn't make a fuss, just very modest, just moved on. I think also the other thing was that, you know, she had seen some very terrible things. She'd seen people blown up. And I think that was the other side to Mum, that she'd seen just what war did to people. And so the idea that you would ever take any kind of glory or pride in that, I think she would have probably struggled with that idea.
It's a difficult one to celebrate the achievements and the innovations that came with the horror, because you don't want to glorify the brutality and the sheer horror of war.
No, you don't. And I think it's a tension, isn't it? And it's one of the tensions that the whole history of technology has, is that so much technology has been pushed through for military purposes.
And things that are invented innocently, if you like, then are used for what might be perceived by many as evil purposes. It's not the fault of the technology, it's the person using it, isn't it? Or the motivation is not in the machine, is it? It's a difficult one.
Yeah. But I mean, it's just sad that lots of the financial backing for developing new technology, it comes from governments backing military research. That's why we've got sat-nav.
Of course, yeah. So we'll think that when we get down a dead end.
Kerry Howard is a researcher on a mission to dig out untold treasures on the subject of Bletchley Park. She's also a writer and independent publisher, and most recently she's added Bletchley Park podcast roving reporter to her already impressive CV. We caught up at the launch of the Bremont Codebreaker Watch in the mansion.
I got in touch with Portsmouth High School, where one of the Bletchley Park Codebreakers went to school in 1917, and they were absolutely thrilled to have a Bletchley Park Codebreaker as a former student, and so they've invited me down to go and speak to 35 girls about Margaret Rock and her time at Portsmouth and also how she came to be at Bletchley Park.
You've probably told me before, but can you rewind and just tell me what sparked your interest about Margaret Rock in particular and why you started researching her?
Well, I'd been researching Captain Ridley. He'd been a sort of a long-term project for a while. And then I watched the Bletchley Circle and I thought, oh, it'll be quite nice to do an article for my website about women codebreakers. And I thought, female codebreakers, there's very little on them. And something about Margaret just resonated with me. I was quite struck with her, and I got in touch with her family. And I'll never forget it, because I phoned them up and they said, well, you'd better come up for the weekend, there's too much to see in a day. And of course, you know, I did the proverbial sort of happy dance and went up, and you know, there's just a ridiculous amount of material about her and also from her family about her. So you build this picture of Margaret through letters between her and her brother and her mother, and the letters that she's written, particularly to her mother, there's a couple which actually talk about her time at Bletchley, one being caught in the Blitz, coming back to Bletchley in September 1940, and the other is like helping out in the canteen on a Saturday night before she goes and checks on the night shift girls in the cottage. And there's a picture of her with Dilly, and obviously she came in 1940, Dilly died in 1943, it's quite clearly in their Bletchley era. I mean, uncovering this is what drives my passion and also the Bletchley Park research, because there's still so much to uncover.
It's so appealing, isn't it? The thought that there's so much we don't know, and you know, let's not put too fine a point on it. We haven't got long to talk to a lot of these people who are left, obviously Margaret's not, but you know, it's fascinating to find out about these people who achieved incredible things. We've never heard of them.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the figures we know in history are those who are covered, who publishers think, you know, we can publish books and make some money on them, where, you know, the current digital age means that there are no gatekeepers. Websites mean that we can talk about these untold stories, and for the first time, you know, they have their own value, and it's not monetary, it's like fascinating and history. And that's like a real revolution, I think, the whole digital age. And obviously
publishers will weep to hear you say that.
But it's true.
Yeah.
And also, you know, we're talking,
democratised information in a way, hasn't it?
But it's ironic, isn't it, the fact that the start of the programmable computer was here, and now we're talking of that freedom of sharing information about Bletchley through computers. You know, I find, you know, that's totally fascinating.
And it's clearly passion for the subject matter that drives you, rather than commercial.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
On what, you know, what will sell a lot of books.
I'm just a born researcher, and I love to find stuff out. You know, I get a real kind of enjoyment and a tingling of the spine when you uncover something that would aid and throw open the doors of further research. And then people say, oh, I remember that, and comment again, and then that's where more information comes out. And in fact, me going down to Portsmouth, the woman who's arranged it from the school, her friend's aunt was here and she worked in the cottage, and then her Tate. And so I'm going to try and find out more information there. That each story leads on to more stories, you know, it's sort of never ending. And people think, oh, nobody's going to be interested, and yet, you know, the world is fascinated.
We could do with your diligence, attention to detail and desire to uncover the untold stories, really. Can we get you more involved in the podcast?
Oh, absolutely. I really enjoyed when I came down and interviewed some of the veterans. When was it? April?
The Royal Visit,
yes.
February.
And recently I interviewed Michael Smith, because he was kindly helped in my Margaret research by talking about Dilly Knox for the accompanying website that goes with the Book of Letters. But also, we talked about his life as a writer about Bletchley, you know, and how he came to write about Station X originally, and his transition into writing fiction. And I think that in itself was a fascinating insight into somebody who has a world-class authority on knowledge of Bletchley.
We touched upon the sort of the freedom of access to information that there is thanks to the digital age, and how research and information doesn't necessarily have to be monetized in the form of books. But I wonder how much it may be costing us in terms of record keeping of information, because you're very deep into Margaret's letters. But are we going to have that kind of record of our communications now in 50 or 100 years?
Well, no, and especially as we put more things on the cloud, somebody could then die, and who has access? You know, there's going to be this big cloud of data that nobody necessarily has access to. And also our emails, I mean, do we keep them all? And
it's worth thinking about the way that we communicate, and is it all lost? Are we going to have people pouring through our emails? Because it's worthless at the time, isn't it? Because you don't feel any need to archive what you're saying as you're saying it, do you?
I think there's always a way to keep in touch with, you know, significant figures. For instance, as part of my Margaret research, I've been looking into the papers of Penelope Fitzgerald, who was Dilly Knox's niece. And she was a prolific writer, and she also wrote a biography about the Knox brothers. And there is a library and archive in America that have all her notebooks, and boxes of material. So in there is communication between her and various figures who she spoke to about Dilly Knox, i.e. Mavis and Margaret. And it's hidden within sort of little snippets of those things. But, I mean, paper diary keeping and journal note keeping is also a sort of a dying art, isn't it?
You've got to wonder what in 100 years people will be looking back on to find out what we thought about things now.
I know, it's going to be much trickier, isn't it? Or Facebook, the archive of Facebook and Twitter.
It's so boiled down. It's so oversimplified. Lots of lols.
I know, I don't lol.
Lord help us. No, I don't.
Sir Arthur Bonsall was talent spotted as a potential codebreaker by a Cambridge Don and was brought into the government code and cipher school early in the war. He went on to serve in the German air section, working in Hut 4. He stayed on with GCNCS after the war and became its director in the 1970s. He came back to Bletchley to be interviewed for a forthcoming documentary, and we grabbed the chance to talk to him about his time here, unearthing the little-known history of why there's a ring of stones around the oval outside the iconic mansion.
I got bits of comic poetry were written. My wife was given at the time by Patrick Wilkinson, a don from King's College, Cambridge, who wrote a poem. I forget what it now offhand. Don't remember what it was called.
It was The Other Side.
Oh, The Other Side. Called The Other Side. She left me an original. She was given, because she was referred to in it. And she got a copy from Patrick. It was given a copy by Patrick. Now, it's actually an original version. There are several copies of this poem. It's not an I've got the only copy or anything. In fact, Patrick wrote a book in which he quoted the whole thing anyhow, so it's absolutely old. But the point is, this is an actual wartime copy. It's on the sort of coarse paper which was used. Would it be of any interest for the archives here?
Absolutely, yes.
And it's got an interpretation, because it referred to a lot of the people without their full name and so on, but in terms of things that, that will be known about them, you know, describe them. Douglas Nicol, he was a member of Hut 6, and he stayed on after the war, and he actually is quite well known as an author. He's written several of the biographies of the senior people wartime in Bletchley. There is a famous collection of biographies, isn't it? Is it the National Biography?
The DNB, Dictionary of National Biography.
That's it. Yeah. He's an a regular author in that. Well, he helped me produce a commentary on the interpretation of this poem, and that's attached to my copy of it. So I would like to hand it over.
Yes.
Providing I'll be sure it will, you know, it'll be kept.
Yeah, we'd love to have it. Thank you.
It does mention your car, doesn't it?
Yeah, yes. Yes. My car was known as Boadicea. Because it looked a bit like a chariot.
Oh, wonderful.
It was that sort of thing. The line is something like, Miss Wingfield, something, 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 where she wants to go. Boadicea.
Something, yeah.
Anyways, it refers to her. Doesn't mention me as owner of the car. She has rode in it.
You're incidental.
But Patrick Wilkinson was in the Italian naval section, and so members of it, like she was, tended to get referred to more in this than the people in Hut 4 who were only in the German air section.
You were here when Churchill visited.
Oh, yes.
What can you remember about
that? Well, what I remember about that is that there was absolutely no publicity beforehand. In fact, it was probably the reverse of that. Anyway, I didn't know he was coming, nor did any other ordinary member of this place. And it was during my lunch break. I was then, I think, working in Block A, I think. I was going for my lunch break, walking across, approaching this circular lawn from that direction. And as soon as I got inside the lawn, I noticed a group of, well, yes, young women clustered out here on the edge of the lawn. And as I came across it, I, to my astonishment, saw that they were listening to Churchill. I mean, the last thing I was expecting to encounter. And what had happened was he'd been visiting Hut 6 and Hut 8 and places like that earlier in the morning. A group of girls hadn't been spoken to by him. They were just juniors. He'd been dealing with the sort of the top cycle breakers and so on. And they had all said to each other, well, we're not all going to say goodbye to him. So they guessed he would leave before lunchtime. And they had spent their lunch break standing outside there in a group. Churchill came out of the front door. His car was parked just outside these windows, Big Daimler, just outside these windows, with an ATS driver sitting in it, looking straight ahead, nowhere else. And he wasn't making an important speech. I mean, it was just an exhortation. Carry on the good work, you know, that kind of thing. And I just managed to catch the final words. And he then got down off the stone he was standing on the edge of the lawn there, straight into his car. And by the time his car reached the corner there, he was already reading documents from a big red box.
Straight on to the next thing. Before he'd even left the premises.
I think he was going up to lunch at Blenheim. I guess that was it. Haven't been able to prove that, but the rest of it, I do know that he stood on the stone where that peasant one is. And my guess is, and Judy knows all about this too, after an incident in the previous year, in 1940, he came in 1941, previous year, it was a sunny day in the summer of 40. And various people were standing around on this bit of grass, and a sports car suddenly shot across it. The young man got his foot jammed on the accelerator, rolled across, fortunately not hitting anybody or anything, but the management here immediately recognised the danger that, you know, there always were likely to be people hanging around out there on the grass on a nice day, and this might happen again. So I can't remember now how many days, but my memory is they seem to have reacted very quickly to have found a source of suitable stones to put round the grass, right round it, so no car could get onto it. And later, my guess is that they'd suddenly thought of there's some dry stone walls in the rock garden. They knocked them down and got the big stones out of the bottom, enough big stones for, say, 30 or 40 stones, something like that. The gardeners got a wheelbarrow and they wheeled them and they put them around this thing. Within days, it couldn't happen again. And it seemed to me that it'd be quite an idea to put a little memorial of this event in the form of a stone. So Judy and I, with the aid of the gardener here, were shown some possible stones which he had found in the...
Well, I think we looked at them while in the lake. Bottom of the lake, didn't we?
Yes, yes. Anyway, there were lots of stones in the bottom of the lake. And I think what happened at the end of the war, when the post office took over this place as a training establishment, they didn't want these great stones around the grass because it made it difficult to cut the grass up against a big stone. And the nearest place to dump them was back, was in the lake. So that's where, and there are a lot there now. And I think that, and hope that, restoring it to its wartime appearance will include getting these stones out of the lake, putting them back in a ring around the grass.
Well, if we do, I wonder what else we might find at the bottom of that lake.
Yes, indeed.
Interesting to think.
Thank you.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @bparkpodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.